Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Explicit language warning. We're cursing a lot in this episode, so don't listen to it with your kids. Or do. I'm not their mother. Welcome to The Waves, Slate's podcast about the terror of gender, feminism, and today, one of Canada's worst exports. It's not Howie Mandel. Not this time. Though we do feel very sorry about that one. Every week, we talk about what fresh hell is being unleashed on the girls and the gays, the theys and thems, and anyone else similarly committed to a society free of cis male dominance. Indeed, this is a community full of she sheds. No man caves! I'm your host, Sachi Cole. You probably know who Megan Thee Stallion is, otherwise known as the hottest woman in America. That's actually fact-checked. You can look it up on Snopes right now. I will wait.
My next song is Cash It, and this song just went platinum. It's my first it's my first platinum song ever, so yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Woo! Real hot girl shit. Yeah, I'm in my bag, but I'm in his too. And that's where every time you see me,
But maybe I have to tell you who Tory Lanez is. Here he is yelling about where he is from, as we all do sometimes.
What's poppin'?
Canada!
Brand new whip, just hopped in.
Tory is a rapper from, like he said, Ontario, Canada. But I have serious, significant doubts that you know him from his music. In all probability, you know who Tory is because of what he did to Megan in 2020. Here she is telling part of her story to Gayle King of CBS last year.
So I get out the car and it's like everything happens so fast. Yes. And all I hear is this man screaming, he said, dance, and he started shooting. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, he shot a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I was so scared.
So is he in the car, shooting from the car, Megan?
He is standing up over the window, shooting. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even want to move. I didn't want to move too quick. Like, cause I'm like, oh my God, if I take the wrong step, I don't know if he can shoot something that's like super important. I don't know if he could shoot me and kill me. Like,
were you afraid for your life at that time?
I was really scared because I had never been shot at before. Mm-hmm.
In July 2020, Tory and Megan were friends. They were on their way home from a party at Kylie Jenner's house. And while driving back, Tory and Megan got in an argument, and he ended up shooting her in the foot. This case has been ongoing for what feels like the majority of Megan's career. But since the shooting, she's made more music, like this remix with Beyoncé.
I'm a savage, had a tooth nasty. Talk big shit, but my bank account match it. Hood, but I'm classy. Rich, but I'm ratchet. Haters kept my name.
And then she won a Grammy for this performance, which tells us that there really isn't anything worth doing that does not involve Beyoncé.
If you know me, you have to know that ever since I was little, I was like, you know what? One day, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be like the rap Beyoncé. That was definitely my goal. And I remember I went to the rodeo for the first time and I saw Destiny's Child perform. And I was like, you know what? Yes, I'm about to go hard. I love her work ethic. I love the way she is. I love the way she carry herself. And my mama will always be like, Megan, what would Beyoncé do? And I'm always like, you know what? What would Beyoncé do? But let me make it a little ratchet.
But last week in particular was another pivotal moment for Megan, because it was time for Tory Lanez to be sentenced. It's been clear for a very long time that he did indeed shoot her, even if there are plenty of uneducated goons on the internet who think she's making it up. Megan's story about what happened with Tory is pretty clear. She has physical proof of her injuries, and he promised her money if she kept her mouth shut about what he did. But despite so much undeniable proof, it seemed perfectly possible that Tory would get just a slap on the wrist. And then we would have to tolerate an album cycle from him built entirely on Megan Thee Stallion's very toned shoulders and all of her suffering. But hey, sometimes the world can surprise you.
The verdict is in. Tory Lanez found guilty on all three counts in his assault trial, where he was accused of firing gunshots at Megan Thee Stallion. Less than a month after court proceedings began, the Canadian rapper now awaits sentencing. He faces more than 22 years in prison and possibly deportation.
Tory got a 10-year sentence, and it's possible that he could get deported back to Canada. And since his sentencing, there have been plenty of people online banging the same drum. That Megan lied, or that he doesn't deserve this much time, and that he didn't even do anything wrong. So I called Kathleen Newman-Bermang to talk about it. She's the deputy director for Refinery 29 and a Torontonian to boot. So what stuck out to you the most during Tory Lanez's sentencing? Like, did 10 years seem proportional? Did it seem expected?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about expected, but I think it seemed proportional. One of the things I saw online, of the many infuriating, frustrating things I saw online during this trial and during the sentencing, were people saying that 10 years was too much for what he did. And that, to me, is ridiculous. So, okay, I want to list off the three felonies that he was convicted of. Assault with a semi-automatic firearm, having a loaded unregistered firearm in a vehicle, and discharging a firearm with gross negligence. He was convicted of all three of those. The highest sentence he could have gotten was 22 years. He got less than half that. So to me, 10 years, that's a long time, yes, but it seems proportional, absolutely. And I actually think he should have got the full 22, because this man shot Megan Thee Stallion, and there is no debate about that. That's another thing that I think stood out to me. Like, we're at sentencing, and people are still talking about whether it happened or not. It happened. He was convicted of it. It was ridiculous. So yeah, 10 years, you know, and he's probably not going to serve that full time either. So yeah, I think it was proportional, and it did feel, as much as you can say this in the American justice system, it did feel a bit like justice.
Yeah. And what do you think it means that he got the 10 years? 10 isn't nothing, and I really thought there was a chance that he was going to get nothing. So I'm curious, it's not like a precedent setter, but it does seem to be saying something that he got any time at all.
Yeah, and I think that has a little bit to do with his complete lack of remorse. And how much the defense kind of changed their story, went back and forth, and Tory still, you know, to this day refused to apologize or to admit that it happened. And so I think that, you know, when that comes to sentencing, judges very much are like, okay, you're going away for a while if you can't even admit to this or feel any sort of remorse. But I also think it's telling that you, and I felt the same way, were like, didn't think he was going to get anything, that it was going to be like a slap on the wrist. And I think that speaks to a larger issue of how Black women are treated in America, and how little we're believed and how little we're respected. And that, I think, is indicative of a larger issue and of the misogynoir war that Black women face in the justice system, and especially victims of gendered violence.
It's actually interesting that we're even talking about this case, because when Tory first shot Megan, she didn't even want to go to the police at all.
This is an example of how Black women consistently protect Black men over themselves, because in trying to protect her abuser, Tory, she lied and said that she had stepped on glass, and that's what the cuts on her feet were. You know, there is body cam footage of her feet bleeding profusely. And, you know, she lies and says that was because she stepped on glass, not because of gunshots. And she does that to protect Tory. She does it to protect everyone else in the car. And because she did that, that fueled this narrative. And, you know, it's something that people keep coming back to. Well, she lied. Why did she lie to the police? Are you kidding me? Why? Like, we know that the police are not people to be trusted. They are not an institution to be trusted by Black folks, especially not in America. And so, of course, she tried to do something to protect them. And so it is so frustrating, I think, to see that because she lied to to try to protect herself and to protect Tori, it is now being used against her. And I think that one of the biggest things that, you know, I've been saying over and over as this case has been playing out for 3 years is that Megan didn't want to come forward publicly at first about this. She would have let people think that she stepped on glass, and she would just have known forever that Tory Lanez shot her, but she didn't want the public to know. It seems like, and I'm speculating here, but that Tory Lanez got scared that she was going to tell people. And so he started pushing this narrative that she was a liar. He started bringing up really, you know, sexist comments about her dating history and just spreading all of these lies about Megan. And so that's when she named him as the person who shot her, was because Tory Lanez made this a public spectacle. And that's the only reason she came forward. And then also, it's important to note that the case was brought against Tory Lanez, not by Megan, but by the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. And at no point was Megan Thee Stallion on trial here. Like, she's had to relive the worst night of her life, this horrific, traumatic event, and she's had to just, like, convince people it even happened. I truly can't imagine. You know, she wrote an op-ed in Elle after the sentencing came down, and she said that, you know, she said, I've had to watch my abuser call me a liar. I didn't even think that I would have to prove to people that this happened to me. And yet, that's what she's had to do for 3 years.
I've been watching this case along with everyone else, and I have realized that there's something kind of familiar to me about Tori's general disposition. The arrogance, the inability to shut the fuck up to his own detriment, the fact that he and I are around the same height, and I'm not tall. And then, while on a recent trip to visit some friends and some family in Canada, it hit me. Tory Lanez is just a Toronto man's. Of course, it's not that complicated. He is part of the subsection of men who come from the general Toronto area, the sometimes cloistered suburbs. These men like to say they're from Toronto, but that's like people from Long Island saying they're from New York City. Very offensive. They also share some, how do you say, behavioral commonalities. Tory, along with basketball player and former Khloe Kardashian paramour Tristan Thompson, both come from Brampton. The Weeknd and Daniel Caesar hail from Scarborough. If you're American, I know the concept of the Toronto man's might seem foreign, but for a lot of Canadians, namely women of color, we know the Toronto man's well. And guys, he's worthless. And he has been crossing the border. He lives amongst you. So why so down on a Toronto man's? Well, you'll hear about it from a local. We talk more with Kathleen all about Megan, Tory, and the Six right after this break. Hey, Waves listeners. If you're loving the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Thursday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes too, like last week's about why all those First Lady hopefuls want to be Jackie O. Welcome back to The Waves. I'm Sachi Cole, and I'm joined by Kathleen Newman-Bremang, Deputy Director of Refinery 29 and notable Torontonian. We're talking about the recent sentencing of Tory Lanez for shooting Megan Thee Stallion, specifically why his abhorrent behavior feels so emblematic of the Toronto man's. And man's, by the way, is Toronto slang derived from Jamaican patois. It just means, like, a Toronto guy. Have you ever wondered why Drake is always performing patois despite being from Toronto? We have also been asking this very question. Kathleen, our audience is mostly American. Our producers are American. I'm wondering if you can tell me, as if I am not Canadian, as if I never lived in Toronto, what is a Toronto man's, and is Tory Lanez one of them?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and I looked up the Urban Dictionary definition of a Toronto man's. And I'm dying at it, so I would like to read it in full, please.
Please, thank you.
Okay, a male from age 20 to 40, typifying the urban Drake wannabe, the Toronto man's wears Canada Goose knockoff parkas and athletic gear at all times. At least one item of apparel must bear the logo of the Raptors or the Toronto Blue Jays. chains and Axe body spray are mandatory accessories, as well as the cheapest item possible that bears the logo of an expensive brand. Toronto man. Toronto man's use the word bro twice in every sentence, unless they're trying to be really classy, and then they'll say brother. And despite the name, Toronto man's is probably from Mississauga.
Oh my God.
I mean, the accuracy. It is, that is pretty on point.
Wagwan Shirty, what are you saying right now? You're blessed? You're blessed? Say what, you're actually blessed right now. All right, so like, man, just had to come over here real quick, guys, because I saw you moving from across the street, and I was like, hey, yo, you're actually looking like a sweeter ting, I lie. So I came up, I was like, hey, yo, and now I'm shooting my shots. Like, what are you saying about that stuff?
A Toronto man's is really like, you know him when you see him, or smell him, or feel his hand on the lower part of your back as he needlessly slides behind you at a bar that is empty. It is an empty bar.
It is. You know, I don't think you could talk about Toronto man's without talking about them in like the adjacency to dating, because Toronto man's are very focused. And you can see this in the music of Drake or Tory Lanez, very focused on women, very focused on dating. And we're talking about like, obviously, cis, straight Toronto men's. And it just shows up in a very specific, ridiculous way. And I think the commonality is the veneer of niceness or like emotional intelligence. So that man like creepily touching the small of your back is trying to pretend that he's like one of the good guys. This is like classic Drake. He had that like good guy, nice guy stereotype, right? And I think that that plays into like the Canadians are so nice stereotype, which is usually like rooted in whiteness a lot of the time. But this plays into that like stereotypical Toronto man's, and Drake is their king. Most Toronto man's are black or men of color. Like Simu Liu counts as a Toronto man's. I also know some white Toronto man's, which are the worst because they don't know they're white. So that's a bigger problem.
Can you run me through some Toronto man's that international audiences would know?
Yes. Tristan Thompson is a Toronto man's. From Brampton, also like Tory Lanez. I think they are the worst breed of Toronto man's, clearly, based on the examples. Drake. And then Tory Lanez is now the ultimate.
What about The Weeknd?
Oh my God. Oh my goodness. if Drake is the king of Toronto man's, The Weeknd is the prince, of course. I'm so sorry I forgot him.
He's also the prince who's like trying to slit his dad's throat so he can be the king. Because I think he's like the brightest example for a lot of people because they watch what happens. So I'm wondering, how would you contextualize The Weeknd as a Toronto man's? What is it about his behavior in the last couple of months that really crystallized it? Because I feel like we saw it in Toronto like 10 years ago when he started coming up. Nobody liked him. Nobody local liked him.
I didn't watch The Idol because I just couldn't. But I think the character that he plays in The Idol is like very indicative of like the specific havoc that he was wreaking through Toronto. He and like his crew, which includes Drake, for a long time. But also, you know, it's interesting because The Weeknd is not like that nice guy, good guy stereotype at all. I don't think at any point you would ever have said that The Weeknd was.
But he was sensitive, remember?
Exactly.
He started as like moody. Yes. I don't want to go to the party. I just want to hold your hand.
Yes, exactly. And I think The Weeknd stands and his music stands in stark contrast to like that very like American black masculinity. And I think that's also where Toronto man's like that lane that they live in, which is like standing in contrast to being American, but also desperately trying to be American. I think Toronto as a city does this a lot. Like we position ourselves beside New York. We talk a lot. Our industry doesn't have its own like real star system. All of our celebrities are American celebrities because they move there and become American. And I think that identity crisis lends itself to these men like not knowing who they are, but also trying to posture and be like, I'm not just big for Toronto, I'm also big for the States. And in that, it's like an insecurity that they take out on women that they date and on women in general. And I think that this is a very complicated way to say that they're trash and that they're, as we say in Toronto, they're waste men. And that is what The Weeknd is. And I, again, like to go back to Tory Lanez, I think that, you know, we started this off by being like, who is this man? Like, who is this person? How are we even having this conversation of him in relation to Megan Thee Stallion, who is like this beautiful, exceptional person, artist, just so talented. And Tory Lanez is like this little man who is he? We don't know. And I think that is like such a good example of a waste man. Like they cannot bring anything to the table.
Well, what do we make of that? It seems like the Toronto Mans has really gone global, and there's so many of them in the States, and we know them because we know some of their worst behavior. So there seems to be, is there something endemic about this to a certain subsection of Black men in Toronto? It seems like it's tied up in their concepts of masculinity, in their feelings around capitalism, their feelings around sort of American exceptionalism and Canadian frailty. Like what is it? They just, why do we have so many, Kathleen? Why am I finding them in New York?
Tory did say something about being Canadian to try to defend himself at some point in this case. And it speaks to all the things that you're speaking about, which is like that insecurity about being Canadian, but also that assumed like specialness, like I am Canadian, so therefore I am different. And the way that they extol their masculinity and, you know, kind of participate in the patriarchy is different, but it's almost more insidious and frustrating. And I think Drake is such a good example of this, because Drake is a guy that has a song called Nice For What, where that video, you know, he trotted out all of these incredible women and tried to, you know, call himself a feminist and say that, you know, he is the rapper. We know how ingrained misogyny is in hip hop, and how horrible that genre has been to women, specifically Black women. And Drake tried to set himself apart. Like, I am not a part of that. For the last month, Saturday, call the girls, get them gassed up. Gotta hit the club, gotta make the ass jump. Gotta hit the club like you hit the motherfucking angles. With your phone out, snapping like you Fable. And I think his Canadian-ness definitely added to that, him trying to separate himself. And then this is the same guy on a song with 21 Savage, said, this bitch lie about getting shots, but she's still a stallion. So that, of course, I mean, some people have tried to defend him and say that this is not about Meg the Stallion, but of course it is. And even if it wasn't, he knows that that is how it would be interpreted, because it was right when the trial was going on. And so he is implying that Megan the Stallion lied about being shot, which is just so infuriating that this man that claims to be a feminist would add to the fire and add to the horrible misinformation that was going on about Megan Thee Stallion, add to, you know, just this narrative that Black women shouldn't be believed when they are victims of gendered violence. Like, it is just makes my blood boil. And I think that he has been able to get away with all of this because of this, like, I'm different. I'm not like that other, like that example of Black masculinity that is so American. I'm Canadian, so I'm different. I hope forever that people remember Drake's lyric about Megan Thee Stallion. And now that Tory Lanez has been sentenced and that we know the facts of this, that this never leaves him. And Drake doesn't do interviews, but in every interview he does from now on, I hope someone asks him about this. I hope in every comment section, he has to be reminded of this. I hope this man never knows peace, because this lyric is so heinous.
Okay, let's take a quick break. I wanted to tell you to stick around to hear our Slate Plus segment. Every week, Slate producer Shayna Roth recaps And Just Like That, the Sex and the City sequel where everyone dies. This week, Shayna's got me on the show to talk all about episode 10. It's part one of a two-part finale because this show does whatever it wants, apparently. And if you want to support our show or any of the shows you hear on Slate, consider joining Slate Plus. Members get benefits like zero ads on any Slate podcast, no hitting the paywall on the Slate site, and bonus content of shows like this one. To learn more, go to slate.com/thewavesplus. We're back. I'm Saatchi Cole, and I'm here with Kathleen Newman-Bermang. So Megan Thee Stallion is a really good rapper. She's really beautiful. People like her. She's likable. She's popular. And Tory Lanez sucks. So I am trying to understand why there were so many people so ready to shit on her and so ready to support him. Like, this isn't a Johnny Depp Amber Heard situation where Johnny Depp has more celebrity capital.
He is famous by association. He's popular by association. And Megan Thee Stallion is like, he doesn't even come marginally close to her success or her talent, to be honest. And I think that's part of why he hates her. I think that's part of why he did this. I'm sure is jealousy. But I think that this is misogynoir war fully at play. This like distinct oppression the Black woman faced, that is the intersection between sexism and racism, which was a term coined by Professor Moira Bailey. I think that this is just an example of that. Like, the fact that Tory Lanez is nobody, the fact that Tory Lanez is bad at his job, and Megan Thee Stallion is beloved and she is so good at her job. Like, I didn't even know Tory Lanez had fans like this. These are just people who, oh, you shot a Black woman? Cool, I'm gonna ride for you now. Like, it is wild to me, but is so just proof of this concept of what Black women face, because Megan Thee Stallion is beloved, again, beautiful, famous, rich, and this is what she's facing. So imagine what happens to Black women who do not have her social capital, who do not have her wealth. I mean, I don't have an answer for you as to why this is happening, other than racism, other than the world hates Black women. There is no other answer, I think, because if you look at it logically and legally, all the evidence is there, all the facts are there. This is the truth. It has been proven in a court of law, and people are still quick to not believe Megan Thee Stallion.
There's always some discourse whenever Black men enter the judicial system about whether or not it's fair and how it's rigged. This comes up a lot, often when the person accusing them of harm is a Black woman. It's like one of the first things that comes up now. It's a thing to sort of hide behind. Were you finding that that was happening a lot? I felt like I was reading those opinions from some Black men who really were like, this is unfair, he's being railroaded.
Yeah, for sure. There's that like intra-community strife that happens all the time. And I think it happens more often to protect Black men than it does to protect Black women. We saw it with R. Kelly over and over again, where, you know, the majority of his victims, I think all of his victims, were Black girls and Black women. And there was just, yeah, so much of a defense for him, because this is just the system trying to bring a Black man down. The same rhetoric was used with Bill Cosby. And I think, you know, two things can be true. The American justice system oppresses Black men, and the system is rigged against Black men who are wrongfully accused and imprisoned unjustly all the time. Also, Tory Lanez shot Megan Thee Stallion, and he was convicted within this system and will serve time for the crime that he committed, justly. Those two things can be true. I think we can hold those two truths at the same time. And I think that the people that try to use that first argument that does have truth to it, I don't think they're doing it in good faith. I don't think they're doing it to try to actually change a system that, you know, wrongfully imprisons Black men disproportionately. I just think they're trying to make an excuse for whatever Black man they're caping for in the moment. Because if they were really against this system that harms Black men, they would also be advocating for the same system that harms Black women in a different way. And in certain cases, especially in this one, and in even more harmful and disgusting, frustrating way.
It feels like the vitriol against Megan Thee Stallion was especially big. Like, it was bigger than even what I would have expected if you told me this was happening 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it was bigger and specific because it was an example of misogynoir war. And I think we saw that play out in real time in court and on social media with Megan Thee Stallion, you know, led by bloggers and podcast hosts who know nothing about court cases, like DJ Academics. There was so much misinformation spread about the trial. There were, you know, fabricated details coming out before court had even started for the day. And I think when you look at how Megan was treated, despite all the evidence, you can't look to anything but ingrained oppression and a system working against Black women, because logically and legally, there is no debate. You know, this man was convicted, charged, and sentenced. Tory Lanez shot Megan Thee Stallion, period. But I think because Black women are not believed, and because there are, you know, the strong Black woman stereotype that fits into misogynoir, that Black women need to be this perfect victim, which we know does not exist. But even if they were, because there's this idea that we are stronger and that we cannot be harmed, that we are the aggressors, that we are the ones that perpetrate the harm. I think that's at play here. And I think people look at Megan's size, you know, there's colorism coming in here because she is a dark skinned, thick, tall Black woman.
There was always something about her physicality too, as if being strong and tall would somehow protect her from getting harmed, which does not make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense at all. But exactly, it's because Megan is a tall, like physically strong Black woman that she couldn't possibly be a victim, even though Tory Lanez had a gun, even though, you know, we saw the x-rays with the bullets and the bullet fragments in her feet, even though, you know, there were the neighbors who heard the gunshots, even though Tory Lanez was arrested that night for holding a concealed weapon. Like, all of these facts are there. And yet, you know, Megan must have been the aggressor. Megan must be the one lying. It was just like a portrait of how Black women are seen and treated. And it's really disheartening and sad, but also like a really good case study in this. Like, it's just proof that misogynoir is real. It's just proof that this is how systems and the public and society treats Black women.
It is clear that there is misogynoir and harm being done to like Black women within hip hop in particular, and sort of how we move forward with that. Because if Drake is, if, you know, some of these figures are really powerful, so what do we do? Like, how do we protect the Black women that are in these spaces?
I mean, I think that's why it's been so tough to watch this unfold, because, you know, there was a lot of talk after the Me Too movement about how it never really got to the music industry and how it never really hit hip hop specifically. And I think that the reason is that hip hop was built on misogyny. I think that, you know, if you look at the lyrics from 50 years ago, when we are celebrating an anniversary of hip hop, and you can see how far back this goes and how ingrained it is. The abuse in the lyrics, the just like bragging of how these Black men treated Black women, it's all there. And so it's really hard to take something out of the fabric of a genre. I think it's really hard to take something out of the system of it. And so I don't know where we go from here. I think that, as we've been saying, you know, this is just a shining example of what Black women face, people who do not have Megan Thee Stallion's fame and power and wealth. But when you do have the fame and the power and wealth, especially in the hip hop industry, you are held to a different standard. And, you know, I think that because the people in power in this industry are men, they're going to continue to use that power and wield that power in a way that harms women. And I don't know how that changes. I think that we can't look to hip hop as, you know, a radical political space anymore. And I think there's a debate about whether it was ever.
At least not in this particular conversation. When it comes to how Black women are treated, it seems like there's still a lot of regression.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Yeah, it's not unique to hip hop, but yeah, that's always been there. So, you know, can it be radical and political, even though we know that that has existed in hip hop? But can it be truly, if it hasn't been intersectional, if it hasn't protected Black women? I don't know. I mean, Dream Hampton, who is such a pillar in hip hop and has been for years, she was just talking about this, and she said that it, you know, it can't be. You can't call it a political space that is, you know, a breeding ground for activism if it excludes Black women. And so as much as Black women have held up this genre, and as much as Megan Thee Stallion is, you know, one of the most successful hip hop artists living right now, and is, you know, a star in rap and is why the genre continues to have relevance, Megan Thee Stallion is right there doing that alongside these men and better than these men. And she is still being a victim to the way in which they wield their power. And that is really sad and frustrating. And I really don't know where we go from here. I think, you know, what we can do is just continue to support the women who are doing great work in the genre, like Megan Thee Stallion, like Cardi B, like a Rico Nasty. That's what you do. You know, you just continue to like support your faves and believe them and, you know, hope that they have support and protection around them. And I just hope Megan Thee Stallion, you know, finds peace through all of this. I don't have anything like uplifting to say though, because I don't think there's an easy way to say, yes, women in hip hop, this is your way forward, because it is too ingrained, honestly.
My thanks to our guest, Refinery29's Kathleen Newman Bermang, a woman with a crisis of abundance of last names. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to turn off my DMs and my comment section, but thanks for having me.
All right, we made it. Another week in Megan Thee Stallion's America. As ever, we cap out today's episode with our moment of zen in a segment we call You Owe Me an Apology, wherein one of our listeners tells us about someone who owes them an apology. Today's guest is Caroline Moss, founder of G Thanks Just Bought It, a product recommendation company that is steadily making me broke. Take it away, Moss.
You know who owes me an apology? The man who hit my Hyundai Kona 5 weeks ago and left me to drive a rental car for the foreseeable future because it's very hard to get parts for cars. This man and I were driving on a residential street. He was going one way, I was going the other. All of a sudden, I notice he's drifting into my lane. I stop my car, I honk. He still drifts. I'm honking. He rams into my car. We get out of the car and I said, "What was that?" And he goes, "Oh, I know someone who lives over there, so that's where I was looking." Okay, say sorry. He never did.
If you know this man, please tell him to do the right thing. That's our show this week. I'm Sachi Cole. I'm your host, and I wrote and executive produced this episode. The Waves is produced by Shayna Roth. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer. Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at thewaves@slate.com or find me on a plethora of social media platforms at SCAACHI. We want to hear your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams, and of course, about who owes you an apology. Please direct any complaints or criticisms to the sky, the trees, the birds, the beauty of nature. The Waves will be back next week. In the meantime, don't let the man keep you down. Hey Waves listeners, it's Shayna Roth. Your Slate Plus segment this week is another episode of our weekly And Just Like That recap. Every week from now until the end of August, I'll be taking over your weekly Plus segment to talk about season 2 of the Sex and the City sequel series with your favorite Slatesters like Daisy Rosario, Heather Schwedell, Luke Winkie, and more. If you're not currently a Slate Plus member, you can sign up now by going to slate.com/thewavesplus to get bonus content for The Waves, along with all of the other Slate podcasts. You'll also get unlimited access to the Slate site. No hitting that pesky paywall. Go to slate.com/thewavesplus to learn more and sign up now. slate.com/thewavesplus. Welcome to The Waves. This is our And Just Like That recap, episode 10, Guess Who's Coming to the Last Supper. I'm Shayna Roth, senior producer at Slate. And I'm Sachi Cole, and I'm hosting The Waves on Slate Podcasts for all of August.
Every week, we're recapping the latest of season two of HBO's Sex and the City sequel series, the fashion, the quips, the WTF moments. Sachi, I have been loving having you as our host on The Waves these last couple weeks, and I am so excited to talk to you about And Just Like That. And since this is your first time on this particular recap, I want to start by asking you, what is your history with this, we will call it franchise extended universe?
I watched some of the show when it was like on HBO. I definitely watched the terrible movies because they were hysterical. But I've kind of always been on the periphery. So I feel like And Just Like That is the only time I've really watched any of the Sex and the City universe in real time.
So have you seen all of the original Sex and the City episodes?
I've seen some of them not in order. I've not watched the whole show, but I definitely know everything that happened. So like I know why we're all so worried about Aiden. I do understand that.
So this is fascinating because everybody else that we've had on, including myself, has seen all of the original episodes and has been super fans for a very long time. Why did you want to watch the And Just Like That series then?
I think it's a really funny show. Like, it doesn't seem to like follow a lot of the logic that other TV shows like this follow. I think it's a cultural juggernaut too. Like, it's kind of fun to be a part of the zeitgeist with a show like this. I'm not watching it the way I would watch like a prestige drama, certainly, where I'm like trying to figure out what happened or whatever. Like, I'm watching it because it's candy and it's really fun. And I mean, I think like the original Sex and the City, not like there's a lot of episodes that do not age well. And I just don't really want to like rehash that with a 2023 lens. There's no need. But this came out today. So it's more fun to talk about it, I feel like.
Though many argue, and I think the show itself would admit, that they are trying to fix a lot of those things that did not age well in the original.
Yeah. It's not really working, but I kind of respect and admire it's like watching a dog wear shoes and walk outside and it's just like kicking at him and it's not working, but it's trying.
It's trying so hard. What have you thought of this season so far?
This season's better than the first season of And Just Like That. I guess I don't really understand what it's trying to tell me or where we're going or what's happening or what it means. Or what I should think about it. So there's lots of unanswered questions.
Well, we're going to try and answer maybe some of those questions in this episode because this is the penultimate episode. We're going to dive into it. And lucky for you, Sachi, I make the newbies do a 60-second recap of the episode. So I've got my timer ready and I will hold it up for you. I've got 60 seconds here. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, go.
Okay, Charlotte starts working in an art gallery, and all that timer really stresses me out. And all of the girls that she's working with are very fun, and then they go out for drinks, and she gets wasted and, like, ignores her family, and it's beautiful because who cares about her family? And then Carrie buys a giant apartment the size of the Mall of America in the middle of Manhattan, and I still don't understand where that space physically is in New York City. But then Aiden has a whole thing with his son who steals his car and crashes it and because he was drinking, and I don't know what's happening, but maybe they're moving to Virginia. I'm not sure. And then Seema says, I love you to the director. I do not know why. I think they made Lisa miscarry, which is, I have several thoughts about that. Oh, God. Che was mean to Miranda in a stand-up thing. And, Naya's ex is pregnant. And she bought them a very expensive pram. Oh, Stanford is a monk?
I totally forgot about Stanford as a monk. There's always so much going on with this show that I can never keep all of the storylines straight. It is impossible.
Stanford's a monk.
Let's do that first, and then we're going to do things a little bit different this episode. We're just going to dig into all of our central characters and what has been happening and where this might be going in the final episode. But first, let's hit on that Stanford thing, because I know that Willie Garson died in real life, and that's the main reason that his character is not on the show, but they never finally wrote him off on the show. They never killed him off on the show, and so Stanford has sort of just been out by himself. So to bring him back, or his character back, with a badly photoshopped picture saying that he is now a monk, I don't know, man. I don't know that I needed it. It doesn't feel quite right. What are your thoughts?
The entire Sex and the City universe seems obsessed with closure. And I appreciate why, because it's such a, again, because it is a cultural juggernaut. The show's been on the air for like, it's been in our zeitgeist for like 25 years. I can appreciate wanting to be able to close chapters when you are in a role for such a long time or you're talking about these characters for such a long time, but there's no way to give you closure about most of this because they are having real life things happen to these actors out off the show. And that's why we can't have closure on them. So it was odd. I get that they didn't want to kill him and there was no need, but I also don't know anybody who was like, where is he?
That was just some of our Slate Plus segment. If you want to hear the whole thing, go to slate.com/thewavesplus to become a Slate Plus member today. Slate.com/thewavesplus.